As the protests in Turkey continue to escalate, the Turkish media are being criticized for broadcasting music and cooking shows rather than covering the people in the streets. The protests began over the redevelopment of the last green space in the center of Istanbul. They've exploded into anger over authoritarian rule. And Bradley Manning's trial began on Monday. He's the army soldier who's accused of giving classified documents to WikiLeaks. Coverage has been fairly light, and so much of it is on whether he's a hero or a traitor. Where is the substance? Where's the information about the actual leaks? Where did you see the best reporting this week? Join us after the news.
BBC News with Gaynor Howells. United Nations aid agencies are making the largest appeal in the history of the UN to help fund their relief effort in Syria and neighbouring countries. The appeal for an additional $4 billion this year expands the original request for $1 billion. Speaking in Geneva, the UN Under-Secretary General for Humanitarian Affairs, Valerie Amos, said the number of Syrians needing help had increased significantly.
We estimate that 6.8 million people now need urgent help. That is one in three Syrians in need of urgent humanitarian assistance. And between January and April, the number of people displaced within Syria more than doubled.
The appeal comes 2 days after planned peace talks on Syria were postponed until July at the earliest. A senior European Union official has condemned the excessive use of police force against anti-government protesters in Turkey. Speaking in Istanbul, the European Union Enlargement Commissioner, Stefan Füle, said those aspiring to be EU members must strive to attain the highest standards of democracy.
Peaceful demonstrations constitute a legitimate way for these groups to express their views in a democratic society. Excessive use of force by police against these demonstrations has no place in such democracy. What is important now is not only to launch swift and transparent investigation, but also to bring those responsible to account.
The Turkish Prime Minister, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, whose government wants to join the EU, said he was open to democratic demands, but called for an end to the demonstrations, describing some as acts of terrorism and vandalism. President Obama is expected to press the visiting Chinese leader Xi Jinping on cyber attacks when they hold their first summit later today in the California desert. Ben Wright reports from Washington.
The leaders of the world's two largest economies will meet at a private estate in the Mojave Desert. The informal setting may encourage candor on a number of contentious issues. The United States is very concerned about cyber attacks on the American government and businesses. China denies it sponsors the hacking. Another potential tension is North Korea. It conducted a third nuclear test in February, and China remains its closest ally. US lawmakers and human rights groups have also urged President Obama to press for the release of 16 prominent prisoners, including the Nobel Peace Laureate Li Jiabao.
President Obama has sought to reassure the American people following revelations that U.S. intelligence agencies have conducted large-scale surveillance of U.S. telephone records and foreign internet use. Mr. Obama said nobody was listening to the phone calls of Americans, but he said measures were needed to keep Americans safe while protecting privacy. He said the surveillance programs had been approved by Congress. You're listening to the World News from the BBC. A suicide car bomber in Iraq has hit a bus carrying Iranian Shia pilgrims, killing at least 8 people. Police say the attack happened in the Muqtadiya district about an hour's drive from Baghdad. It's the latest in a wave of attacks believed to have been carried out by Al-Qaeda-linked militants trying to provoke renewed sectarian conflict between Shia and Sunni Muslims in Iraq. The Queen has officially opened the BBC's new headquarters in central London, new broadcasting house, live on radio. Queen Elizabeth listened to a live music performance, toured newsrooms and entered a BBC radio studio. The Queen pressed ahead with her official engagements while her husband, Prince Philip, was in a London hospital for exploratory surgery. Peter Hunt reports.
It has been a tale of two royals in two different locations undergoing two very different experiences. After a night in hospital, his fourth such stay since 2011, Prince Philip was due this morning to have an operation on his abdomen under general anaesthetic at the private London clinic. Meanwhile, just around the corner, the Queen fulfilled a long-standing engagement and visited the BBC's headquarters broadcasting house. In a first, not an easy achievement after a lengthy reign, she declared the building open during a live broadcast.
Buckingham Palace says Prince Philip is progressing satisfactorily after his surgery. The German Chancellor, Angela Merkel, has urged Tunisia to ensure a fair trial for three European women who staged a topless protest there last month. Mrs. Merkel said she raised the issue during talks with the visiting Tunisian Prime Minister, Ali Larayed. The women were arrested after demonstrating in solidarity with a detained Tunisian activist from the feminist group Femen. Libya is hosting its first international football match since football's governing body FIFA lifted a ban imposed 2 years ago at the start of the revolution that toppled Colonel Gaddafi. Libya is playing the Democratic Republic of Congo in a World Cup qualifier. BBC News.
Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Last week, activists and environmentalists in Turkey took to the streets to protest the redevelopment of Istanbul's Gezi Park, the last green space in the center of the city. Since then, tens of thousands, perhaps even over 100,000 people, have taken to the streets to express anger at Prime Minister Erdogan and his authoritarian rule. Demonstrators told one of today's guests, Justin Vella, that Erdogan has limited personal freedoms, such as recent restrictions on alcohol, to promote conservative religious values. He's bullied the country's media into submission through arrests of journalists and by intimidating or co-opting media barons. Most local stations opted to broadcast music and cooking shows rather than covering the protests. So far, three people have been killed, more than 4,000 have been injured in a dozen cities, and 915 have received hospital treatment. Justin Vella is a freelance reporter based in Istanbul. He's reporting on the protests for Foreign Policy magazine. Hi, Justin. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
It's great to have you. And media coverage of Bradley Manning's trial has dropped off since it began on Monday. Manning is being charged with, quote, aiding the enemy for giving classified military documents to WikiLeaks. The New York Times called it a, quote, sharp drop. The Huffington Post reports that the big networks gave hardly any time to the trial. NBC's Brian Williams spent 43 seconds talking about it, calling Manning the, quote, man who may have put U.S. military secrets in the hands of Osama bin Laden, end quote. And other than MSNBC's Rachel Maddow and Chris Hayes, the trial was barely mentioned on the cable shows. So what are we missing? And where are the details of the actual trial? We'll be joined in just a couple of minutes by Kevin Gostola. He's been covering the trial from the very beginning. On May 30th, he was informed that his media request to cover the trial had been approved. 350 requests were submitted. 70 seats were available. Michael Doyle has also been covering the trial. Michael is a national correspondent with McClatchy Newspapers, where he covers legal affairs, courts, the U.S. Supreme Court, and the U.S. DOJ. And Michael is also covering the Obama administration's large-scale surveillance program. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the show.
Good to be here.
Great to have you. So as we always do on Friday, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So, Michael, why don't we start off with you? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
I'd start out with the Washington Post's remarkable reporter Barton Gellman and his colleague Laura Poitras. They were the ones who opened up Washington's eyes this morning to the news that the National Security Agency had been reportedly scooping up vast amounts of data from the central servers of nine major companies, Google, Yahoo, Apple, Facebook, and so on. This has accelerated attention paid to the role of the intelligence community and U.S. privacy. It was a remarkable story, and I recommend anybody to read this story, not only for the facts of it, but for the writing of it. Bart is a very, very clear writer, and you cannot help but follow him from start to finish.
It's interesting because President Obama is in Silicon Valley for big fundraisers this weekend.
And in fact, just about 40 minutes ago, President Obama took some questions and he defended the program without speaking in specifics, both the phone system collection of information revealed earlier this week concerning Verizon and the electronic data mining. And President Obama essentially said these are under programs authorized by Congress. It's fully legal. We strike a balance, and it's all intended to protect the U.S. national security. So he spoke at considerable length. People could, again, to the Washington Post and other news sites, find online exactly what he said, and it's worth listening to because it was a very vocal defense.
And so this is an initiative codenamed PRISM, and according to the Post, it gives the FBI and NSA access to audio, video, photographs, emails, documents, and connection logs from the servers of Microsoft, Yahoo, Google, Facebook, PalTalk, I've never heard of that one, and AOL, Skype, YouTube, and Apple. So all of the major ones. Did these companies comment in the Post article about what they're actually giving and why they're doing it?
Yes and no. There were comments in the Post article from several of the companies. Essentially, and people should read their accounts to let it stand on their own, but essentially the companies denied any wrongdoing and to some degree denied knowledge of any operation called PRISM, or said that there was no backdoor access to allow government to vacuum up information in vast quantities. So there is some conflict between what the companies are saying and what the Post is reporting. James Clapper, the director of National Intelligence, late last night gave the Post a statement saying it would be reprehensible and despicable to reveal a program that would endanger the U.S. security interests. So there is absolutely no doubt that over the next few days we're going to see some additions to this reporting, and maybe the company's reactions will evolve over time.
Do you also think we'll see more reporting about the very close connection between these companies and the U.S. government?
I have no doubt that particularly reporters with agendas or advocates of any kind will begin to make connections. The well-sourced Bart Gellman is a neutral reporter. I have the highest regard for him. I don't think his agenda is simply to find the facts and tell a great story. There are other well-sourced reporters like Glenn Greenwald, who broke the story on Wednesday in the Guardian newspaper about the FBI obtaining Verizon documents. Glenn is an advocate. I mean, he's a reporter, but he's got an agenda. And I think the combination of agenda-driven activists with straight up and down neutral reporters are going to inevitably draw out more information than we have at present. Mm.
Well, thank you for that. We'll put links to those stories on our website. That's Michael Doyle, national correspondent with McClatchy. And now I would like to welcome Kevin Gostola back to the show. Kevin covers civil liberties and national security issues for Fire Dog Lake. Hi, Kevin. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. So, as you know, Kevin, we start off on a positive note on Friday and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So what did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I heard you talking about the PRISM stories, so I won't make that my selection. In fact, I'll pick out something from a fellow colleague who has been in the press pool with me covering the Bradley Manning court-martial for the past year or so. And his name is David Dishno, and he writes for the Associated Press. And he put together a nice overview that I recommend people find. I'll probably need to read it off of the Huffington Post just because the Associated Press updates their stories. But it's under the headline, Bradley Manning Trial Characterized by Secrecy and Security. And I particularly like this because he took the trouble to bring out how some aspects have taken on a, quote, cloak and dagger feel, pointing out that photographers have been having trouble getting shots of Bradley Manning because military police tried to surround him on Monday, so it was hard to get a good shot of him. Talking about what happened inside of the courtroom when supporters of Manning were told for the first time that they could no longer wear their black T-shirts with white letters printed that read truth. And they were apparently banned and told they had to turn them inside out. And this was a decision made by some military police officer. Was not a good decision. It ended up being something that the commander condemned the next day and said they should not be doing. and there was no legitimate purpose for it. It seemed to be intended to just send a message to the supporters that they were going to control the courtroom. And so anyway, if you read the story, you get a nice overview of some of the secrecy and security issues at the trial.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm looking at it now, and David Dishnu actually puts those details in the second graph of this story, that large parts of the proceeding are closed to the public, documents are being withheld and heavily redacted. And it's so interesting about the photographers and the T-shirts, but we'll definitely talk about that a little later in the show. So kudos again to David Dishnow and Eric Tucker of the AP for this piece about the Bradley Manning trial, which we will cover on today's Your Call. Thank you for that one, Kevin. And what about you, Justin? You're reporting from Istanbul on the protests in Turkey. And what did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Unfortunately, the level of journalism in Turkey is so low that I have to, instead of talking about something that is done well, talk about something that was done poorly. And that was by a local television station here in Turkey, one of the main national channels, NTV, which had a presenter reporting in front of Gezi Park. And there was a number of banners that had been hung by protesters from this building there. And what the TV station did is censor out part of the banner. What the banner said was "Shut up, Tayyip," a reference to the Prime Minister, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who's the focus of the demonstrators' protest here. And they censored out the part of the banner that said "Tayyip," and so behind the presenter, you just saw a banner that said "Shut up." I'm not completely sure how the TV station managed to do that, but they did. And it was an extraordinary level of censorship of the media here in Turkey.
Well, it's interesting because in your piece in Foreign Policy magazine, you report that many outlets, local stations, are broadcasting music and cooking shows rather than covering the protests. So is this mostly television that's not covering the protests?
It's actually all across the board. Television, newspapers, the few local magazines that exist, none of them have focused on the protests to the extent that they should have. Certainly, I mean, there has been protests in more than 70 cities across Turkey at this point, and for the most part, you see either completely normal coverage or some very extreme examples, such as cooking shows on CNN Turk, or music shows on the government television station. There is even a case of them of a television station showing a documentary about penguins at a time when there was some of the most violent clashes in central Istanbul, the country's largest city.
Well, what is the current state of the media in Turkey?
Turkey, despite being a NATO country, despite being a major ally of the United States and a candidate for joining the European Union, has more journalists jailed than China and Iran. There's nearly 100 media workers currently in jail in Turkey. And it means that the level of journalistic censorship is among the highest in the world. And this has been achieved in part by the jailing of individual journalists, but also what you've seen in the past few years is the government target entire media companies or the holding companies that own the media groups here. And so what you might see is that a conglomerate that has, for instance, a construction company and a media company within it is targeted for not paying enough taxes, or you might have a government minister go and request a meeting with the owner of the entire holding company, and over lunch he'll explain that the media company under this group is making some mistakes, and if they want to avoid further complications with the government, they should limit either certain publications or even individual journalists. And so you've seen journalists actually lose their jobs after these sit-downs of sorts have happened.
And the Committee to Protect Journalists, like you said, calls Turkey the world's leading jailer of journalists. In recent days, 30 journalists have been arrested for using social media. And the Prime Minister recently called Twitter the worst menace to society. Is that
it's
right?
It's really surprising. Yeah. It's surprising that Erdogan, the Prime Minister of Turkey, who for years has actually been celebrated as a Democrat, is turning so strongly against social media. Erdogan himself has a Twitter handle. The president of Turkey is active on Twitter, as well as the foreign minister. But because of these protests, Erdogan has turned against social media, and you've had dozens of people or tens of people arrested because of their use of social media. Some of these people have been arrested in the past days, but then released yesterday. And there are still, however, a number of individuals that the government says that they are seeking because of what they've been posting on social media. I think it's an extreme example of how the government is feeling very threatened by the protests here, and also wanting to avoid comparisons to the Arab Spring countries, where you saw social media become a very important part of how those demonstrations overthrew the regimes across the Middle East.
That is Justin Vella. He's a freelance reporter based in Istanbul. He's been reporting on the protests in Turkey for Foreign Policy magazine. You can find his pieces at our website, yourcallradio.org. Kevin Gostola has been covering the Bradley Manning trial from the very beginning. He covers civil liberties and national security issues for Fire Dog Lake. And Michael Doyle is a national correspondent with McClatchy Newspapers. He's been covering Bradley Manning, and he's also been covering President Obama's surveillance program. We're getting a lot of emails about that, and we'll definitely get to those a little later in the show. Justin will be with us for the next 8 or so minutes. So if you have any questions or comments about the protests in Turkey, which again began last week. A number of people were taking to the streets to protest the redevelopment of Gezi Park, the last green space in the center of Istanbul. Since then, tens of thousands of people have expressed anger at authoritarian rule. So what are your thoughts on the media coverage of this? What questions do you have for Justin, who's been on the ground interviewing people at these protests? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. And I'll have Kevin and Michael, if you have any questions for Justin, I'd love for you to ask them. But before that, Justin, why don't you just quickly talk about the grievances of the protesters? When you're interviewing people on the streets, what is the story they want you to get out?
I mean, what they want to get across is that they feel that the Turkish government, which is led by the Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan, is becoming increasingly autocratic. The government here in Turkey was reelected to power in 2011 with about a 50% of the vote, and this is a huge amount of the country, a good showing for a parliamentary democracy. But what's happened in recent years is that people have become increasingly threatened by the fact that the government seems to be rolling back civil liberties. And you see this because of the arrest of not only journalists, but thousands and thousands of members of the opposition, intellectuals, academics, really anyone that opposes the government seems to end up in jail. And on top of that, you get accusations from members of the protesters here who believe that the government has a kind of agenda to impose a more religious agenda here on the Turkish society. And they see this in the fact that just recently there's been some legislation passed here in Turkey that restricts the use and advertisement of alcohol. And you also see the Prime Minister, for example, come out and say that he wants to raise a golden generation of observant Muslims here in Turkey. And so all this is quite threatening to people here that are more middle class, more liberal, who, even if they might be, might identify as Muslims themselves, they want a greater degree of freedom to choose how they want to leave, or how, excuse me, how they want to live, rather, their individual lives.
It seems fairly similar to the protests we saw in Iran in 2009, after the protests, and the anniversary of those protests is happening in just 2 weeks.
I think that there needs to be a big differentiation made between Iran and Turkey. Turkey is a democratic country to a large extent. It's not democratic in the same sense as the United States or large parts of Europe, but it's not Iran. The situation in Iran and the Iranian government are far different than the government here in Turkey. Many of the demonstrators might feel that the government here in Turkey would like to take them in the direction of Iran, but at the moment it's quite different. And I think that the government here in Turkey has not shown the same degree of violence towards the demonstrators as the Iranian government did in 2009. The degree of repression here by police has been intense, but so far you can't compare it to the violence in Iran in 2009, which was extreme in the other direction.
Well, do you see similarities in terms of the people on the streets and what they're calling for?
To a certain degree, yes. I think what's really happened here in Turkey in the past 2 years is you've seen actually a large intensification of you have people from all different parts of society calling for a greater degree of democracy, a greater degree of participation from all aspects of society. The country right now is about to rewrite, or currently rewriting, its constitution. All the constitutions in Turkey thus far have been written by military governments, so they're currently trying to write their first civilian constitution. And all the different aspects of society want to make sure that they're represented in this constitution, and therefore they're agitating hard for the government to take them into account. And the current demonstrators are largely middle class and wanting to make sure that their rights are represented well in this new constitution, I think.
And before we let Justin go, Michael Doyle, do you have any questions or comments for Justin about what's happening in Turkey?
I do, Justin. The Prime Minister was recently in Washington to meet with the Obama administration. Is it clear, or how is the U.S. relationship with the Erdogan administration perceived? Is the United States seen as playing a backstage role in any sense, or just steering clear of the whole mess?
The United States, and particularly the Obama administration, has a very close relationship with the Erdogan government here in Turkey. They are essentially best friends. There's a great picture of President Obama speaking to the Prime Minister Erdogan in a very casual manner with his baseball bat. Some people might think that that's an aggressive gesture, but I take it as a sign that these guys are buddies. And they expressed that again when Mr. Erdogan was in Washington, that they're extremely close allies. And Erdogan, to a large extent, will agree with Obama on his foreign policy decisions, particularly regarding the conflict in Syria.
Justin, we have to go to break. Can you stick around for a few more minutes because we have a few callers on Turkey?
Sure.
Okay, great. We're speaking with Justin Vella, freelance reporter in Istanbul. Michael Doyle is a national correspondent with McClatchy, and Kevin Gostola covers civil liberties with Fire Dog Lake. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. We'll be back after this.
All the stories you hear recommended on the Friday Media Roundtable will be posted at yourcallradio.org. They're also included in our weekly email newsletter, which is free and easy to sign up for. Just go to yourcallradio.org and click on the email newsletter link. We invite you to join today's conversation about the reporting you thought was valuable this week by calling 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK, or you can send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Programming here on Local Public Radio is supported in part by the 12th Annual SF Documentary Film Festival, featuring over 60 great nonfiction films from around the world and around the Bay. This two-week-long event brings quirky topics of the moment, issues, personal stories, and other weird and wonderful aspects of real life to the big screen. Information at sfindy.com.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we will have a conversation with the organization The Thinking Moms Revolution. They've got a new book telling the story of 23 moms and one dad from Montana to Malaysia about their effort to fight the effects of autism and other disorders. So we'll talk about how parents are organizing, what have they learned along the way, and if you have a child with a learning disorder, what has your experience been like? On Tuesday, we will talk about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. This is the latest free trade deal from the Obama administration. So much of this deal has been done behind closed doors. So we'll talk about what's in it and how do these trade deals under the Obama administration differ from the Bush administration, if at all. And then on Wednesday, we will have a conversation about the conditions in detention centers where immigrants are held in the U.S. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it's our media roundtable. We're talking about coverage of Turkey with Justin Vella, freelance reporter based in Istanbul. In a couple of minutes, we'll talk about coverage of the Bradley Manning trial with Kevin Gostola. He covers civil liberties for Fire Dog Lake. And Michael Doyle is a national correspondent with McClatchy. Michael and Kevin have also been covering the administration's wide surveillance program. So we'll definitely get to that. But first off, before we get to calls, Justin, anything else you want to say about the relationship between President Obama and Prime Minister Erdogan?
I just wanted to highlight that the relationship between President Obama and the Prime Minister of Turkey, Erdogan, is extremely tight-knit. Turkey is one of the closest United States allies in the Middle East, it's the relationship between the two men is extremely good. I think that Prime Minister Erdogan made a very big mistake today, though, where he compared the current protests happening in Turkey to the Occupy Wall Street protests in the United States. I think it was like a year and a half ago, he made a claim that 17 U.S. citizens were killed, which is not true. And the United States Embassy issued an extremely strong denial of that. It's a sign that Erdogan is so uncomfortable with these current protests that he's hitting out even at his closest allies.
Well, they sure have a lot in common when it comes to the response to the protests. We've got a number of calls on this, so let's go to Stephen calling from San Francisco. Hi, Stephen. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. My question is about the coverage of the protests themselves. Based on contacts with my Turkish friends, it seems like they have been overwhelmingly nonviolent, bringing out broad cross-sections of Turkish civil society, not just in Istanbul, but around the country as well. Yet in media, we're treated to this kind of riot porn, you know, just images over and over again of the minority of confrontations where protesters fight back. And And it's similar to what we've seen with Occupy, with Seattle in 99, or Cairo, or other places, that if it bleeds, it leads kind of mentality. And I was wondering, you know, what is your impression of this overall coverage? Is it indeed disproportionate on the rioting? And what can we learn about the majority of protests, which are nonviolent?
The majority of the protesters have been completely nonviolent. This has been an extremely peaceful set of protests. I myself saw a lot of violence inflicted upon the protesters. At one point, they gathered completely non-aggressively in Istanbul's central Taksim Square, and after standing there for about 20 minutes, the police completely unprovoked fired tear gas canisters into a mass of several hundred, if not, you know, more than 1,000 people, setting off everyone fleeing down the side streets of Istanbul. I saw tourists carrying young children affected by the tear gas. They were very, very confused. It seemed that the protesters had no interest in being violent at all. They wanted to make a point that they were, in fact, completely nonviolent. And when they stood up to the protest, when they stood up to the police, rather, and allowed themselves to be shot with tear gas and water cannons, they just got more of it. It was only a very small number of people I saw throwing rocks or even tear gas canisters back at the police. It was, by and large, completely nonviolent.
And, Justin, where is this going? What are people telling you? What are their plans in the near future?
Well, I live right next to the Taksim Square, and what is happening is, the protesters are stockpiling water, food, and medical supplies to be able to remain in Taksim Square and Gezi Park for as long as they feel necessary. They don't feel like they have been, there's not any degree of adequate apology from the Turkish government. And so you see the protesters digging in for what could be a long summer.
All right. Well, we'll definitely follow this and we'll have you back. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Justin Vella is a freelance reporter based in Istanbul. He's reporting on the protests for Foreign Policy magazine. And now we're going to talk about coverage of Bradley Manning's trial. Kevin Gostola has been covering this from the beginning. On May 30th, he was informed that his media request to cover the trial had been approved. 350 requests were submitted. 70 seats were available. And Kevin, this was the first time that media organizations were given just one seat each. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. As I understand it, I, up until then, could have had someone else from the organization accompany me because the media center was able to accommodate that.
So 70 seats were available, and the New York Times and other outlets are saying that on the first day, those 70 seats were taken, but then after the trial started, the coverage significantly dropped. What did you see?
That's what happened. And in fact, the New York Times didn't even come to cover the third day. So we were down to about less than 20 reporters, which was maybe slightly above normal, the amount of interest that the media seemed to have throughout the pretrial process generally. And I don't know if that's going to be the case throughout the next week. What the reporters, including the person who the New York Times sent, got the military to do is put out some witnesses' names so that you know 3 days ahead what is going to happen. So we now have reporters making calculated decisions about what they would like to cover and not cover.
Michael, what explains this? Why do you think the coverage dropped?
It's a long story. There are a lot of relatively trivial details, and news organizations are shorthanded. So a lot of news organizations do what I've done, which is from afar. I don't have a credential for McClatchy. We're the third biggest newspaper chain in the country. We care a lot about this case. Well, we didn't apply for a credential because of the logistics of getting out to Fort Meade outside of Washington, D.C. were such, and the fears that we'd be sucked into a story that there's no predicting what will be a good story or not. As a result, I end up, I watch what Kevin does, who does invaluable work. And to go back to what we started talking about, commendable reporting, I'd call up the work of Alexa O'Brien. She does remarkable work. She may be an advocate of some kind. I mean, she has an ideology, but she has done a fantastic job. I would say she and Fire Dog Lake have done the two best jobs of covering this religiously. And what Alexa does is on her website, she'll post all the original source documents. And as a result of that, it is the information is getting out there. I mean, she is not as widely trafficked as the New York Times, but the information is available for people to dip into. So it's a hard story to cover, but it is being covered.
And Kevin, what are your thoughts about how the media are covering Bradley Manning? For example, do you think the word allegedly still needs to be used when you say that he's been allegedly charged with leaking documents to WikiLeaks?
I dropped that word after he read his statement in court and he pled guilty to providing the information to WikiLeaks. There are a few specific documents or a video or files that he did not say he had provided to WikiLeaks, but we're not talking about those. I mean, nobody's talking about this minor global address list or this video of an airstrike in Afghanistan that we never got to view because it was encrypted. So as far as the big releases, the ones that received attention, like the collateral murder video, as WikiLeaks called it, and the Iraq and Afghanistan war logs and the U.S. State Embassy cables and the Gitmo files, those are all sets of information that Bradley confessed to providing to WikiLeaks. So that's how I proceeded forward. Let me just add in here to what Michael said, was that we should be having a little bit of a discussion here about the fact that there is a crowdfunded stenographer that is going now. This organization, Freedom of the Press, has stepped up and gotten a stenographer to the courtroom, to the media center, to be there producing transcripts, and they have funded this with tens of thousands of dollars in cost. This is going to run over $65,000 to $70,000 over the course of this long trial this summer. And I think that we need to consider this reality. The military is not offering the transcripts, and they should be. We should not, the humanity of the world should not have to get together and raise money so that we can have a public record of this trial. And Alexa, in the pretrial process, was the sole person putting out a public record of these proceedings. And so that's something that people need to consider.
If I could just say, I agree with Kevin's statement of the policy. I think the government should be making in real time available the transcript. But in another example of necessity being the mother of invention, the fact that Judge Lind, Army Colonel Denise Lind, and the government declined to make that information possible or available, the media invented this new system. I don't know if there's ever been a case where the media combined to raise more than $58,000 to hire a stenographer to make as close to real time as possible available a transcript for the world to see. And so it's lamentable that the government keeps too many secrets. It's commendable that forced a new form of media.
Well, and then what about the substance of why Bradley Manning is being tried in the first place? I mean, Matt Taibbi has a good piece in Rolling Stone saying that the gist of most media outlets, they're basically saying, is he a hero or a traitor? That was a headline at CNN. Time Magazine, is he a traitor or a hero? This is the question surrounding Bradley Manning. But the question, I mean, there are massive questions that this raises about U.S. foreign policy and how it wages its wars and why it decides to invade countries. I mean, what about that angle, Kevin? Is that getting much attention?
And I think that I'd like to just bring in a quote because there's a author who published a book on Bradley Manning. His name is Denver Nix. And one of the things he told to Time when he was interviewed was this quote, The more conversations we have about Bradley Manning in which neither of these largely meaningless buzzwords is said, the better off we'll be as a country. So I really do hope that more media abandon this dichotomy of looking at whether Manning is a hero or a traitor, because that really doesn't give the public much information on what is going on in this trial. And I think that that doesn't really help us get to the different charges that he happens to face. And I really would like to see more focus on the disclosures, the way that the information benefited the world. I would really like to see more media test some of the allegations that prosecutors are making, as well as maybe even look at the defense's attempts to try to defend Manning and perhaps question whether that is going to serve him in some capacity, and also focus on the reality that Manning did plead guilty to some offenses before and that the military could have not proceeded with this trial. And had they would have potentially been able to put Manning in prison for 20 years. He would have been fined. He would have been dishonorably discharged, discredited. He would not have had much of a future in the United States. He would have had to face for the rest of his life questions about his patriotism. He would have been regarded as a traitor for what he had done by many circles of the United States. So that was not good enough. They decided that they want to get him on stealing the documents. They want to nail him on possibly violating the Espionage Act, and they also want to get him for aiding the enemy. And I think that that's something that needs to be explored.
And same question to you, Michael. What about coverage of the actual information that was leaked? And shouldn't the media be focusing on what the government is trying to keep secret? I mean, Slate has a piece based on the leaked documents about, for example, leaked records from the Afghan war reveal coalition troops' alleged role in killing 195 civilians in unreported incidents. And then the incident in Baghdad in 2007, this got a lot of attention, but a U.S. Army helicopter gunned down a group of civilians, including two Reuters news staffs. So what about that angle?
Well, you put your finger on the fact that the media, writ small, is getting into the details that we're talking about, the details about what information was disclosed in the 750,000 documents, what duplicity was revealed, what horrors of war and so on, covered by Matt Taibbi and Rolling Stone and Fire Dog Lake and Slate Magazine. There are lots of media these days, and I think we should be less concerned with the fact that the mainstream media only has 43 seconds for a piece by Pete Williams to brush over in very broad terms whether he's a hero or whether he's a traitor. That's the nature of the mainstream media. They're going to have insufficient time to do justice to this complicated story, but there is such a proliferation, a bounty of other media sources. We can go to Kevin's work or Alexa's work or Slate's work and find what we're looking for. So I think that this, in the media environment we're in today, the story is being very well covered. And in terms of traditional media, I am certain that there will be very excellent long-form pieces over the course of the trial and post-trial that flesh out exactly what's going on. It won't be in real time, but it'll be very thorough.
That is Michael Doyle, national correspondent with McClatchy Newspapers. Kevin Gostola covers civil liberties for Fire Dog Lake. We've got about 10 minutes left, so if you'd like to weigh in on coverage of Bradley Manning. We'll also spend a couple minutes talking about the surveillance program, but we'll talk about that in more detail next Friday. You can give us a call, 866-798-8255. You can email feedback at yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from Bill in San Francisco. Hi, Bill. Hi, Bill.
I'm here.
Go ahead.
I'm not Bill, though.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, okay. I didn't hear you click.
That's okay.
Yeah, this is David.
Oh, hi, David. Sorry about that.
Yeah, hi. I was interested in the issue of illegal orders. As every soldier is supposed to refuse to obey illegal orders, I would agree with that previous comment about Bradley Manning. Basically, he was told to obey illegal orders. He refused to do them, and now he's being prosecuted. And it's interesting, in listening to people like Sensenbrenner and even Dianne Feinstein, they seem to want to obey the illegal orders. They seem to want to justify these things. And in fact, just the very theft of all of the U.S. Reserves, we don't know how much, for example, they're building this massive facility in Utah. How many billions that's costing? How many billions toward the, I understand Washington, D.C. is being flooded with new buildings, security clearance type buildings, and we the people don't know how much these things are costing. And it's basically, as I understand it, illegal for us to find out. And it's also illegal for the Congress to not only find out, but to discuss it. So that seems to be right on the layers of illegal orders. And it violates our principle of taxation with representation.
All right. Michael, do you want to take that one?
Yeah. I don't know if Dave's still on the line. What order was illegal?
No, we lost okay. Dave.
Well, I would challenge the assertion by the caller, actually. I don't know, and maybe Kevin could speak to this, I don't know that Manning is asserting there was any illegal order. Nobody ordered him to commit extrajudicial killing. Nobody ordered him to commit espionage. Nobody ordered him to do anything that broke international laws or the laws of war. So unless I'm mistaken, I would challenge the caller's assertion.
Kevin, what are your thoughts on that?
Bradley Manning was involved in the process of handing over detainees to Iraqi federal police, and he objected to that because he believed that those individuals were being turned over to federal police who were going to abuse and torture opponents of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. And he objected to a superior officer but was basically told to run along, and this is per his testimony, to run along and get more detainees for the military that was engaged in these operations. And he provided some materials to WikiLeaks. They still have them. They haven't published them for various reasons, but that's just one aspect. Now, obviously, Bradley Manning released a range of material. Just that instance there does not necessarily mean that there were illegal orders pertaining to all of the other information that was disclosed to WikiLeaks. But I think what we're getting to and what the caller is getting to is the credibility of the United States in advancing this trial in a climate where you've got policies that are chilling investigative journalism, are implicating press freedom, where you've got issues of rampant overclassification, and then where you have other cases where you've prosecuted a record number of alleged leakers or whistleblowers, where you've also seen individuals who have engaged in crimes or committed wrongdoing, and those people are not being prosecuted by the Justice Department, and they're getting off scot-free. In fact, maybe even going on to benefit, as in the cases of individuals who were in the CIA, like who had leadership positions, like Jose Rodriguez, who got to publish a book and go on tours where he's talking about how much he values being able to use an enhanced interrogation techniques against detainees, which, you know, I consider personally to be torture, as it has been historically going all the way back to World War II. So we're getting to the larger context here with this caller.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, David. And that seems like it would merit a show. We should probably do another show on this issue. Thank you again. Let's go to George in San Francisco. Hi, George.
Hi, good morning. This is a week for free speech. You could coincide it with the calendar. You could say it was with the 69th anniversary of soldiers storming the beaches of Normandy, the celebrated liberation of Europe. Would those soldiers have rushed the German positions if they thought that their efforts were going to lend a hand to gathering complete surveillance on every one of their citizen brethren? In other words, and not to be too grandiose, it's just hard to get out in front of a story on wide surveillance if a reporter's every contact and confidential communication is subject to incontestable review. And this is the week when we also learned through a split decision, a 5-4 decision at the Supreme Court, that you may not deny access to the inside of your mouth if you have DNA evidence there. And not so far as we've noticed has anyone asked, is that evidence subject to abuse? Can evidence that's collected, DNA evidence is collected, be planted? And now that we have total surveillance of every one of our contacts, where we are and with whom at all times, What is the propensity for abuse when you can plant evidence to incriminate an individual, a person of interest?
Yeah. Well, thank you. I'll get an answer in just a minute. Let's take Greg and Woodside first. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. I just wanted to make a comment about the all the revelations about the monitoring of citizens. I've just been completely floored by it, and I'm just, you know, thinking the America that I grew to love has just completely lost its way. And I can't believe that these politicians are, you know, have had this under the hat for so long, and nobody's, you know, told us about it. And I've been on the phone all day with calling, you know, the senators and congresswomen, and I just set up a petition on the White House website that needs 100,000 signatures to basically get this legislation looked at again to remove the tracking of the communications of the citizens of this country. And, you know, I just feel like our forefathers are just turning in their graves.
Well, thank you. And Michael, you're in D.C. Didn't Senator Feinstein say that this is just an extension of what we've already had?
Well, I heard Senator Feinstein's comments with regard to the earlier revelations from Wednesday of the week concerning the scooping of Verizon telephone records. And she actually attacked the leaking of that information and defended its use. I have actually not seen her comments today with regard to the NSA PRISM operations. But to Greg's point, I would say what President Obama – or I would point out what President Obama said today in San Jose is these measures were authorized by Congress. Now, assume for the moment that that's true. That is making an important point that we, the voters, elected people who seem to reflect our views, our fears, our anxieties, our concerns, our rage after 9/11, and channeled it into laws. And if the president is right, the intelligence apparatus has strictly followed the laws and laws enacted, written by people that we put into office. This is not a rogue government. This is a government of the people acting upon at the people's behest. In other words, people have been very afraid over the last 10 years and have been willing to give the government considerable leeway to protect ourselves.
Well, and even reporters, I mean, we got some criticism today from some listeners about reporters who are also repeating that line about safety. But we'll talk more about that next week. Just quickly, Greg writes in and says, we have no idea how big these operations are. Is there any way for reporters to find out exactly what is being monitored and by whom and how frequent? Kevin, is there any way to find that information?
Let's follow the example of people who are taking initiative to set up leaks sites that can accept communications, and let's admire people who are putting themselves at risk, reporters who are engaging in national security journalism, and unfortunately, now you have to act like a drug dealer or a spy in order to get scoops that give people an insight into national programs and policies, but
Kevin, I'm sorry.
People are doing and help anybody who needs funding or support that work and buy that journalism and support those people.
Well, we're definitely going to talk about this more extensively next Friday. So thank you both so much for joining us. Kevin Gostola is a reporter with Fire Dog Lake. He covers civil liberties. Michael Doyle is a national correspondent with McClatchy. Thank you. And thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. How are moms organizing to help their kids with special needs? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with the founders of the Thinking Moms Revolution. Their new book tells the story of 23 moms and one dad from Montana to Malaysia who are fighting to reverse the effects of autism and other disorders. How are parents organizing? What have they learned along the way? And if you have a child with a learning disorder, what has your experience been like? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.